Thanks for downloading a 3CR podcast. 3CR is an independent community radio station based in Melbourne, Australia. We need your financial support to keep going. Go to www.3cr.org.au for more information and to donate online. Now stay tuned for your 3CR podcast.
Brainwaves, hear the world differently. Bringing community mental health to you, raising awareness and challenging stigma. Tune in to 3CR Community Radio, Wednesdays at 5 p.m.
Melbourne's Drive Time Radio program, featuring community organisations, powerful stories and information. Find us at brainwaves.org.au. Proudly sponsored by Wellways Australia.
I would like to begin by paying my respects to the Wurundjeri people of the Kulin Nation, who are the traditional custodians of the land on which I am coming to you from today. Land where at Brainwaves we tell our stories, and land where the traditional custodians have told their stories for many, many years before us, and continue to tell their stories. I would like to pay my respects to Elders past and present, and acknowledge all Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander listeners who are listening today.
Hello and welcome to Brainwaves on 3CR, 8:55 a.m, 3CR Digital Radio and 3cr.org.au. My name's Mark and joining us this evening is social worker and outdoor educator Will DeBud, co-author of Kids These Days, a book he co-wrote with clinical counsellor Nevin Harper. The book examines several key issues affecting children and adolescents today. Welcome to the show. Will, nice to see you today.
Yeah, thanks so much for having me. What a treat.
So I guess first of all, to get us started, you work as an outdoor educator. For listeners who might not be familiar with the term, could you explain what an outdoor educator is and the role that it plays in adolescent mental health?
Sure. So I probably don't go often by the title of outdoor educator, but that's okay. I'm still I can talk about this. The thing with the outdoors and working with young people is it's just another place to work with them, and it can be an engaging place to work with them. Now, you and I are both in Australia at the moment. The outdoors can also kill you here. So it's not like this wonderful, easy place that is like some utopia. What's interesting in coming from the United States before I came to Australia, like a lot of the history of social work, that's my profession as a social worker, experiential learning, outdoor education, even the start of psychology at Harvard and philosophers like William James, everything, a lot of it was tied to experiential learning in the outdoors. So like even my profession of social work, that was in Chicago, you have Jane Addams. She actually ran a summer camp for kids. She hoped that it would end racism by bringing people together and they can do things together. I'm talking about the early 1900s here. So there's a big link of the outdoors and doing things together that are tied into what we now call mental health. I don't know if we had those terms back then, but mental health. And that what I loved about my work was young people, and I've been really fortunate enough to work at a lot of different places in a lot of different countries. And when I think of working with teenagers, which is who I've predominantly worked with my entire adult life, they're sitting and talking, and I'm happy to do the talk therapy stuff, and you know, I'm trained well enough in that stuff. But there's also this really wonderful thing that happens when we all go do it together. And so, like, if it rains, it rains on everybody. And also, if someone gets hurt, and I'm not saying we're advocating for this, but let's say I got hurt, young people are going to have to do something. Like there's a very realness to what we're doing with young people. So outdoor education has fallen in Australia and in, I guess it's the Western world. It has also become a trap in some ways where it's had curriculum creep, we might call it, where it becomes over. There's way too much curriculum. John Dewey, one of the gurus of experiential education from the early 1900s, said we have a crowded curriculum in the schools. We have to give kids more things to do, less things to learn. So outdoor education is something I'm very particular about, fond of. And so I've spent really the last, over 20, probably about 20 years working with young people in the outdoors for mental health purposes, therapeutic purposes, and sometimes educational purposes. So it's really the combining, for me, I think it's the combining of the word therapy and the outdoors. And so that's been what I think has been an amazing journey, and it's still early days, so it's been fantastic.
The book that you've written, it's divided into three sections. Mm-hmm. Interference, intervention, and ideology. Could you give our listeners a brief overview of what each of these terms means to you?
Yeah, so the book came about because we started with my co-author, Nevin, starting to interview these sort of experts in the field. And we really wanted to know what was going on with youth mental health. Every headline says that everything stinks and everything's horrible. And at the same time, more people go to therapy than ever before. We hand out diagnoses more than ever before. More people are, you know, in Australia, we have a stimulant shortage for young people diagnosed with ADHD. So we're giving away medication more than ever before. So more people are receiving what we might call treatment. But still, nothing seems to shift the needle here. Nothing seems to really, you know, move this a different direction. And so what we had, and the wall, I know the listeners can't see this, but the wall you're looking behind me, we had all these interviews and I put up A3 paper all over it. And I tried to connect, what did this person say that connects with what this person said? Because they, and as I know you've read the book, it sort of could stand alone, like every chapter could be disconnected from the next. And what I started doing was moving chapters forward and backwards, and we started seeing a line where it starts with this idea of interference. How has childhood changed? And we don't mean that by how has it changed from the good old days, because I don't know if those good old days ever existed, really. It's kind of like how every philosopher in the history of the world complained about modern times. Well, modern times is only today. So we started with this idea of interference. And what that looked at was, reported rates of social connectedness have gone down over the last 50 years. Additionally, we have the phone that is interfering with something. And then the wild card was talking to an environmental toxins researcher, and we can get into the Australian context of this further later on as well, that we also have these things that are changing the way our bodies work and interfering in this way. So we looked at these things as what's interfering with whatever the quote-unquote normal is. The chapter, that section of the book, sorry, is one of the important parts is there's also this idea of the kids these days effect that we talk about, which is for millennia, human beings have complained about what's wrong with kids. And it gets funnier and funnier the more in the past you can find these stories, because they seem so ridiculous. Like the fact that New York City banned pinball in the 1940s because of its association to youth crime, and they banned it for 30 years. Like, people were concerned about the kaleidoscope being invented in 1818 because kids are walking into walls, they're so distracted, they won't meet people. Like, this has gone on forever. So there's also this, we better, you know, interfere with what's happening. And that's a very similar word to intervention, the second part of the book, which is much more aligned to my co-author Nevin Harper and I, our professional work, not only as university educators, but as therapists as well, that more young people, that we receive more medications than ever before, as I've said, more people go to therapy. There's also more of what has been called, and we use this term in the book, universal interventions, more school-based emotional learning programs. And is this working? Is this moving the needle? I bet you if we looked on, if social media existed however long ago, like, everyone is so well-versed in mental health language these days, that it's interesting for me to think, what has been the actual outcome of this? Has it led to better outcomes for our children? While simultaneously we hear of, you know, youth suicide is tragic, emergency room visits they fluctuate, but they're higher than they were before. youth reporting, self-reporting of anxiety goes up. These things, I'm going, well, what's really happening here? So intervention is about the interventions that we use. And the last section of ideology is really about, and this is what I think the whole book is about, is how do we think about youth? How do we think about young people? So when we think about, you know, young children today don't roam from home as far as others did. And so it's not that roaming is some panacea for mental health, but it also makes us look at ourselves as adults going, why has this changed? What's different? So ideology is about how we, the ideology is about how we think about young people today. So those are sort of the three sort of points of the three sort of sections, and each one has their distinct, like a family tree, chapters and sections.
A central theme in the book is that many young people feel a deep lack of belonging and are desperate for connection. You use the term fill the void. In trying to fill the void, young people often turn to problematic coping strategies. What are some of these coping strategies you've observed?
Well, so we got this idea from talking to Dr. Martin Brokenleg. This is a Lakota Sioux First Nations elder in the United States. He's actually in Canada on Vancouver Island now. He wrote a book along with two others called Reclaiming Youth at Risk in the early 90s. This book was like the Bible of youth work in South Africa, Canada, northern states of America. And what he said is the biggest problem facing youth today is that they are starving for connection. And similar to Gabor Mate's book, In the Realm of Hungry Ghosts, if you're hungry and starving, you will gorge on things. And so what can happen is quite often we look at young people's behavior and we think of it through the lens, why are they doing that behavior? So, for instance, why are they taking this substance? Why are they skipping school? Why are they on their phones all the time? And the truth is, I would have said this before talking to Martin Brokenleg, but I think the way he put it was so eloquent that if you're starving for connection and belonging, and he called it a spiritual connection, which is they're starving for meaning and for life to have meaning. And so there's something going on that it can't just be the phone that took that away from people. So what we'll end up doing is sort of searching and going on and on for where can this substance or this inanimate object or this risky behavior make me feel better, when you'll never be full, you know, you'll never be satisfied until that connection and that meaning and that belonging is restored.
You mentioned in the book that technology has become a go-to nowadays when it comes to filling the void. How do you see phones, social media, and online platforms shaping the way people connect today?
Well, it's everything. To me, like my criticism about the sort of how this has entered into like a moral panic land, it is everything, and it is something that, I mean, we all use our phones. You see everybody on their phones all the time. And so it's easy in one way to scapegoat the thing that everyone's doing, right? We did the same thing with violent video games, and more video games have only gotten more violent and they've been sold more, but youth crime has predominantly gone down until about 2022 in Australia. So, and that depends on who counts what, and there's a lot of here or there about that. The thing with the phones is the way that they're designed is there are issues about hijacking your alpha waves and also with dopamine, that they keep us hooked to stuff. They also feed us material that it knows that you want, but we also keep clicking on it. So why are we clicking on it? That's how the algorithm doesn't really have an agenda. It just wants you to stay hooked. So it's an issue, but I know we're going to talk about this. It's also an issue that I don't know if we're going about solving this the right way. It's just because if we go back to 2020, when everything shut down, every child in Australia was told, go to school online. You're a digital native. Your whole life is going to be online. If you don't know how to be online, this is not going to work. That's how you stay connected with people. Stay connected online. And then just what, 4 years later, you can't be online. You're not mature enough to be online. And so it's a mixed message of how we're thinking about this.
So, as you mentioned, in December last year, Australia introduced a ban on social media use for children under the age of 16. In the book, you suggest that removing phones may offer short-term relief, but not necessarily address the deep issue at play. What do you think the longer-term effects of this ban might be?
Well, the issue of this ban when it came about was, and I find this is a bit humorous to me, that the legislation was written in 9 days. Now, find me any federal government that has done anything productive in 9 days' time, right? But the issue is, let's say, and I've used this sort of thought experiment before, let's say we all go to bed tonight, we wake up tomorrow, and like little elves or something have come and they've removed all the laptops, all the phones, and they're all gone. What do adults do now? Well, the truth is, whether the phone is here or not, it's the same thing. It's, you know, construct a world that young people feel like participating in. And so quite often, I think of like myself in meetings, sometimes with the university, and I might see my phone creep out of my pocket into my hand going, this is so boring. And it's okay to be bored. It's just that we also have this thing that is remarkable for curing boredom and for turning your brain off. But there's a part of me that thinks, would school teachers have advocated for banning doodling in the classroom? Like, I think of this from a historical perspective, similar to pinball. Like, once this is gone, everything will be fine. But everything typically stays the same. So I was a bit critical about it, and I want to really asterisk this with not that I'm not critical about it because it doesn't feel like the right thing to do. It just feels like when it comes to the way we think about kids and young people, we always other them. They're the ones with the problem with the phone. Well, the mental health rates of adults and kids are the same. We should just outlaw this for everybody. Or the other angle of this is like, In Australia, the age of criminal responsibility is 10 years old. So you're 10 by 10 in most of the states and territories. You're old enough to know right from wrong at a criminal level, but not old enough to scroll YouTube. This is the sort of stuff where it's like, this is a cognitive dissonance where we know the protective factors for kids are strong connection, people holding you up to good expectations, and feeling safe to explore and wander and participate in the world. That's a good democracy.
If restricting access isn't enough, what do you believe would be a more meaningful way to address the connection young people lack in their lives?
I think when I said restricting access, it could be like a stopgap approach. There are still things that we have to look at. You know, youth mental health, or sorry, let me rephrase that. Youth anxiety has declined from the 1950s. This is far before technology fit into our pockets. And so when we look at what to do next, we've restricted the access, that's great. But when we interview young people, their most common cited stress in their life is academic pressure. So again, this can start in the schools. It can start at home. It can start with the adults in kids' lives. And kids these days, you know, we made this pretty clear in the introduction. It's not a parenting book, but it is a book for adults interested in, like, there's no how-to steps, rules. You know, that's where the banning really stood out to me. I just went, this is a perfectly fine idea that in 10 years we're going to look back and go, remember when we thought that would save the world? So it still takes what happens at home, the way we raise our children, the way we interact with other people's kids, the way that we work as therapists with children. And so all of those things, I think, are really important, that we don't just think about blaming an inanimate object, but then, okay, once that's gone, now what? And the now what is, now we have to get back to building relationships that count.
You argue that children don't just need adults to be physically present, but emotionally engaged with them. This means offering love, guidance, and a mature perspective on the world. Without engaged adults around, you suggest young people are forced to rely on their peers to fulfill this role. Why can this resilience on their peers be detrimental to a child's development?
Yeah, so this was something we learned from Dr. Gordon Neufeld, who co-authored an incredible, a wonderful parenting book called Hold On to Your Kids with Dr. Gabor Mate. And what Gordon Neufeld said is that there's too much hype about teenagers that they're leaving the nest, that all of a sudden now they're just peer orientation. You know, they're just with the kids. But what they really need is still some secure adults around. And I don't think that means all of us being the perfect adult. Like, obviously, that doesn't exist. But what it means is that young people have a safe launching pad to go to. And so we see when you leave kids alone, you get stuff like Lord of the Flies, you get gang-related activity when there isn't adults around. And this doesn't mean, and again, I know, like, Hold On to Your Kids sounds like an overprotection book. But what it really means is stay engaged even while they're teenagers. Make sure there's other adults around too. This is something, you know, when we talk about risky play or letting your kid roam a little bit further, we can have our own anxiety about that. But I don't have that same anxiety when someone else's kid wants to, you know, walk a certain distance or when I see kids riding their bike. So if you have other adults around, those are other people that can help you stay grounded in your own worries and nervousness that we all naturally have. So this idea of that kids just need other kids, it actually, the research actually shows they really still do need parents and adults around, not for overprotection, but really for being a grounding presence. Like, I know I've had a really nice relationship with Maggie Dent, who I think is Australia's, you know, the queen of common sense, that we should be lighthouses for kids, that they know where safety is, they know where danger is, they know that they can always come back to this place and it's a safe place to be.
And what needs to change for parents and caregivers to be more available to children?
Well, this is the part of the book that is, I think, what we wanted the reader to get energized about, which is if we wait around for people in power to sort this out, it's never going to happen. And we can talk about this when we talk about toxins as well. Like, the truth is so many of us are overworked, and the phone is a trap of this as well. We bring our work home with us. I'll just do two more emails. Meanwhile, your three-year-old is like, can we go kick a footy, please? Like, can we go do something? So that stuff is really challenging. So we need to make time that we're playing around and going outside. I mean, you can do this stuff anywhere, but that we're being with our kids, being present. So, I mean, even if you look at some of the research we cited, if you want to reduce the likelihood of your child developing a concern surrounding substance use, you'd have dinner at least three times a week together. And I know this is coming from my perspective of being able to do that. Not everyone has different working hours, but those little things are actually really protective for your kid's mental health. Because the dinner table is a great place where people feel like they can have a conversation. They can stand up for their ideas. They can talk things through. They can see you as a real person. So finding time to carve that out is hard for many families, but it can be really important. It can reduce stress down the road.
The first two sections of the book I read almost read like a tribute to researchers who you feel challenge the dominant narrative despite strong opposition. Two people you focus on are Bruce Lanphier, is that how you pronounce that?
Lanphier
and Susan Johnson, mm-hmm. Johnston. Could you tell us a bit about who they are and why their work matters to you?
Yeah, so Bruce is probably the wild card in this one, so I'll start with Sue. Sue is a psychologist, grew up in England, grew up in a British pub, and became a therapist and started seeing in the 90s that everything was becoming cognitive and behavioral. So it's all about cognitions and behaviors. And she thought feelings are somehow off the table. What's the deal with not talking about emotions? And what she did was really just start advocating for that the world of therapy start talking about emotions, how we are in relationship with each other. So she wrote wonderful books. She unfortunately died while we were finishing the book, but she was amazing. And the coolest thing about her, and when we talked to her, is she talked about growing up in her father's British pub and like the way her father would break up a bar fight or the way he would care for someone who had just lost a partner. And she goes, there was this unspoken caring about each other that she's like, why didn't I learn this in school at university while I was studying? What happened at the time, and this happens naturally in the therapy world, is many therapies, and I'm being generalizing here, they're constantly elbowing for power of who has the most popular therapy, who has the most effective therapy. So here comes this outspoken person, Sue Johnson, who says, actually, I think we need to focus on emotions. And many of the people in power are saying, nah, get out of here with that. You know, we've done that before. That's just, you know, who talks about emotions? But she stuck with it. She won the Order of Canada, one of the highest civilian honors in Canada for this. And when we talked to her, she said things like, it's really important that you just know when it's time for the right fight, to get into it. That actually, no, I'm not going to let myself be pushed around about this. So she was someone that was really, I don't know, energizing for us to write a book about how do we deviate from this kind of sometimes stale mental health system. Then you have Bruce Lampfear, who Nevin spoke to Bruce first, and Bruce is an environmental toxins researcher from the United States, currently working in Canada. He's worked with the Attorney General's office in California. He's worked for the Environmental Protection Agency. And Bruce is someone that I thought when I first heard the interview Nevin did with Bruce, I honestly thought, we'll just bury this at the end of the book and who cares about toxins and things like this. But what it reminded me of listening and talking to Bruce was how much a different perspective changes the way you look at something. So when we look at something like attention-related issues, we might think that's just ADHD. Well, a toxins researcher might say that's also lead, mercury, forever chemicals. And I did not want to write a scare the heck out of parents about this. But for some reason to me, it was alarming that that topic was off the table when it's ever present in all of our countries. The other side of talking to Bruce is Bruce will be brought on as an expert on some panel to deal with some, let's say, a herbicide like atrazine. So he's brought into Canada, brought on to review the literature, and he says, actually, there's no chance any of this is safe. We cannot use this any longer. It's been banned in the European Union for over a decade. And then Health Canada goes, actually, I think you need to revisit your literature on this. It's okay. And he goes, I have to leave. I can't be a part of a committee that continues to not follow the science. So they were two people in particular that were somewhat, Sue was less new to me, but Bruce was very new to me, that when I heard what they had to say, I went, there's a metaphor here beyond what they're actually talking about, which is how often we want to go up against the system, up against the man, however we want to say it, and we immediately get shut down. But sometimes it's worth sticking in with what you believe is right and what you think is the right thing to do. And I think those are two perfect people that you picked out of the book that, you know, Sue lived a life of this and Bruce is living a life of this, of really being as evidence-based as they can while simultaneously sticking up for the underdog.
So just to talk a bit more about toxins, you do devote a pretty good section of the book to environmental toxins and their impact on children in particular, you raise the possibility that exposure to toxins may play a larger role than genetics in conditions like ADHD and autism. Could you discuss that for a bit?
Sure. So, again, these are the prevalence data is not something that really interested me that much. But the fact that there is one style of the way that we talk about this was quite alarming to me. I mean, in three generations, the rates of autism has gone from one in thousands to one in 38. Most people go, sure, we test for it more. Well, if that's the end of the discussion, that's the end of the discussion. The other thing I hear is, like, especially in Australia, when NDIS first rolled out, there was more money given to autism. Maybe all the practitioners are money hungry and want more people with autism means more money. That's also a problem. Or this makes sense to toxins researchers, that there's more chemicals around us, there's more things that can interfere with childhood development. So a lot of things, when we look at like a chemical like atrazine, this is a popular herbicide, in agricultural practice, when tested on something like a tadpole, because a tadpole is like a fetus that's outside of the womb, right? So you can see how with animals that develop faster, how these chemicals can interfere with things. And so the issue is, we've had this debate for a long time, nature or nurture. And what Bruce says, it's really nature and nurture. And that there's no way these diseases, even when we look at Alzheimer's, I mean, some dementia studies show a flatlining of this, thank goodness, that there's no way this level of concerns around attention-related issues or autism can be, if we believe the genetic side of it, and I'm not saying I don't, that we should not see this spike. We don't see genes change this way is kind of the point. They don't change this fast. So his argument was there's a nature and nurture. It's not either or. And there's twins, like identical twin studies that show stuff like this. But it's the reason we wrote about it wasn't about what's right or wrong. It was mostly, why is this conversation off the table? And I'll say this in a snarky way here. There's an article in The Guardian in September 2025 that showed environmental watchdogs colluded with the mining company, with the APA, to cover up the level of lead in children's blood in a small community. And so lead, there's first off no safe level of lead to be allowed in your blood. At the same time, the federal government could get together and ban social media in 9 days. So there's a story here about, if this has a much more causal relationship to decreased rates of mental health, why is it off the table? Why is that one too hard to solve? But social media is fine. And there's obviously corporate interests and collusions and all those things. But to Bruce, the story of, you know, I think it was Broken Hill, that story was not surprising at all. He knew some of the researchers involved who were helping to, you know, be the whistleblowers to talk about this story. So what it kind of showed us was there still remains this capitalist view of it's okay to make you sick. And let me say this another way. I learned this from Bruce more recently. If we hear stories of safe enough levels of a toxin, if you knew you had something that could, like Mark, if you knew you had something that could poison me, would you ever start your research going, let me find the safe enough level? No.
I'm my best not to.
Yeah. So it's kind of a backwards way to think about it. So it's not to scare parents, because we all have to make our best choices about how to help our kids live happy and healthy lives. But there's a story here about, who are we outsourcing the helping to? And Bruce and Sue are two people that show that when people get in power, there can be a really slippery slope to preserving their power instead of doing the thing that could really help much more people.
And just for the clarity of our listeners, this is just a hypothesis at this moment. Is that right? Like no peer-reviewed evidence has come to light at this stage.
There's tons of peer-reviewed evidence. I wouldn't call it a hypothesis, but I mean, the research world, what one study finds versus another is really challenging. There certainly is tons of evidence that when you look at only, well, let me say this another way. When you look at rates of autism only through a genetic lens, you will find only a genetic question. Answer: when you add the environment into it, you find that genetics are much less involved in the story. So take dementia. It's not surprising that many people with dementia lived near a golf course, worked in a mechanic's office, worked in a mechanic's garage. We see these increased rates with people that are around these environments more often. In the United States, when it comes to ADHD rates, so with ADHD, there's maps where you overlay blue cities, that's ones with the most chemicals, and then the most rates of diagnosis, and they're all over it. So there's tons of research in both directions. Now, this is the thing that is, I hope that this is communicated in the book, because I think this is the impossible task for parents, is if you only talk to Bruce, you'd be scared of poisons and toxins. If you only talked to like Ellen Beat Hansen Sandseater, the risky play expert, you'd go, why are schools not letting my kids play so much? There's too much information to navigate here. So what we wanted was people to get the information and then be able to make an informed decision. So I wouldn't say it's just a hypothesis. There's research in both directions. And if you can edit this out if you want to not get too political here. But remember a few months ago when Trump and RFK stood up and said, you know, Tylenol or Panadol in this country, Panadol causes autism. And everyone was like, this is ridiculous. The truth is, the most ridiculous part of that sentence was the word cause. There has been 20 years of research about those chemicals and are they safe for pregnant women. I'm not that kind of doctor to tell you what to take, what not to take. But the truth is, it's much more gray if you look at the research. And so, like, I recorded that video of those two talking about it, and I show it to my students and go, what did they do wrong here? Well, they claimed a causation that was never there, but they didn't adequately say, and also there's actually some worries here. Like, there's CNN articles, there's tweets from Tylenol saying, actually, consult your doctor first. All these, like, this is much more complicated than headlines, which I think is the most important takeaway, which is do your best to do your own research, and the noise will distract you from it. So there's tons of research that doesn't hit the light of day. Imagine how hard it was to get lead out of gasoline, lead out of paint. Like, these are hard things to advocate for when a lot of corporations are making a lot of money.
You've also observed that many young people internalize diagnostic labels and begin to define themselves through them. Why do you believe this can be harmful?
So what we have found over the last decade from and it started probably earlier, was this notion that we need to identify by the mental health term that we get. And so one of the things I wrote in the book was that, like, my mother is a breast cancer survivor. And so many things for a woman's journey through breast cancer impacts your identity: hair falling out, surgeries, radiation, you know, my body is changing. My mother never walked around and said, I am cancer. So there's this idea that I am just this. I am autistic. I am attention deficit. I am depressed. I am anxious. When the truth is, you're experiencing these things. They can be described as more of a verb or a noun. If you think of Winnie the Pooh, my name's Will. My mother used to call me Willie the Pooh, so it always sticks with me. So Winnie the Pooh, Eeyore has a cloud above his head. The cloud is not in his head. The cloud is not, Eeyore is not the cloud. Eeyore is experiencing this deep sadness and melancholy. So we found a piece of research that was really illuminating to us. It was with year six students in California. And they asked them, do you identify with having a mental illness? And then they asked them about their self-esteem. 2 years later, the students that dropped the identifying with having a mental illness had the biggest increase in self-esteem. Now, self-esteem can be a bit overhyped. It was very popular in the 80s. But what that tells me is there's a, when young people are diagnosed and centralizing all Western mental health through the medical system means the diagnosis is necessary for you to receive the treatment or care. But what we see now is I self-identify. And this is one thing social media has been very unhelpful for, being the WebMD for mental health. I self-identify, I've undiagnosed autism. And so this has changed. And so I know you're going to ask me about how this creeps into the classroom and into the university, where we're making accommodations for these, you know, identifying labels, which is fine. I'll make any accommodation for what anybody wants. You know, what's the difference to me? I want you to get a good education. I don't mind. At the same time, I wanted to see when the label is put on, when the diagnostic stuff is put onto someone, what next? So quite often it's medication or it's therapy. And then what? How do we know that this label has now really helped someone to move forward with their life? So that is the part that's really interesting to me, where I'd really like, if someone learns something about how their brain works, that it becomes a superpower, that it becomes their way of, this is how I interact with them. No different than wearing glasses. You wear glasses, so you're on the same level playing field as everybody else. What we saw was this sort of rising rates of labeling to keep everything where it's at. So my supervisor, John, my dear friend, he said to me, the important thing is to meet people where they're at and just don't stay there. Go somewhere together. So we see the increased rates of labeling, of internalizing the label, and then we see an issue of, well, where to from here?
From reading the book, it also seems that you're critical of the term neurodivergent as well, if that's fair to say. What concerns do you have about the way that particular term is used at the moment?
The case study of neurodiversity is the perfect story about how this labeling has occurred. So if it was the late 90s, Judy Singer writes this honors thesis in Australia. It's kind of nice that this is, you know, the movement from here. Writes this thesis informed by really amazing feminist literature. And Judy Singer argues that your brain is as unique as your fingerprint. And so what that means is we shouldn't start treating people differently just because they have different fingerprint than you. Like that's another super, having a different critical thinker in your world is fantastic. That's the, like, I work at a university. I'm around different people all the time. It's fantastic. I like hearing people who don't work for universities, what their opinions are. So this was the notion that it was two biological truisms that your brain, your neurological makeup is as diverse as everybody else's. And what happened is this movement changed into this idea, especially over the last 5 years, that someone can be neurodiverse, which is like me saying I am fingerprint divergent. It kind of doesn't make a truism sense, but it turned into I am neurodivergent. What really troubled me about this movement was it also became about othering in both directions. You're neurotypical, so I don't need to hear your opinion. You're neurodivergent, so I don't need to change my classroom for you. it became it almost felt like a political fight. Are you left or are you right? Are you divergent? Are you typical? And so what I saw, and this was a theme as we were writing, this idea of othering people really hit me sort of hard in this way of I was going, this is not where this idea really came from. So I'm not critical or want to question however anybody wants to identify. But what I really was critical of was proponents from both sides were othering each other in both directions. And I don't think that makes for a healthy discussion about something when most of us are just in the messy middle. Our brains all work in different ways and we're not at the poles of a different topic. So I like the idea of the fingerprint, which is you have a fingerprint, I have a fingerprint, and that's cool. We can all be together. And I don't need to label your fingerprint as more, let's say how we do it in sort of the Western system. Your fingerprint is not more attention deficit, depressed, autistic, and you just have a different. So it's a way to move away from the medicalizing of what people experience and create a more inviting place. And I think some of this comes from a lot of the disability advocacy work, which is you put wheelchair ramps and Braille in an elevator. So even every person is welcome in that elevator and we don't have to identify them. They can just use the elevator. So I think what the movement started as was a decentering of labeling. What it's turned into is a centering of labeling. And I think I'm starting to see it change back over the last few months.
Might result in less stigma and increased awareness might lead to dangerous interventions. A major study in 2023 found that gender-affirming care was associated with lower psychological distress. How do you respond to that type of research?
Yeah, I'd have to see the specific study, but I mean, because there's studies in both directions on all things. And this few pages about what was going on with gender and youth in the book was really about how this conversation was taken off the table a little bit, and mostly due to activism and certain types of activism. But what we saw was a massive spike in, and that, again, that could be better awareness, right? What we also saw was surgical treatments, and this is especially the US and England, surgical treatments that many of us would not consent to receiving. We saw, again, time is a really important one here. Like, how long has the study been going on for? Is it just the start of gender-affirming care? Because I would say many people feel less psychological distress when they realize their diagnosis from a specialist. So this is a complicated one we took with the utmost compassion, at least that we tried to, because it can become a contentious topic. And I have zero desire to tell anyone what medical treatment to get or not get. But what we saw were things like, especially like Nevins in British Columbia, where school teachers were instructed not to tell parents of what was going on in regards to gender. I did a study at a school in Adelaide where I interviewed, I think like 100, it's an alternative school, 100 of the students. And what we found was most of the students were saying, I have undiagnosed autism and here's my gender identifier. And I was thinking, I was just there as a researcher, so not like a therapist to question these things. What I thought was, what does this all really mean? Like, what's the utility of this increasing? Because sometimes when things just increase, it can lead to this procedure. So one of the things is we do have the research that's out there from what we have. Of course, there's all research. You have to remain curious because you have to find the next thing and then test that and see if that's right. That some of the headlines of if you don't receive this care, there will be increased rates of suicide. Well, that did not pan out. And so, I mean, I would say for every family, you know, the journey of gender and to do that the way, go about that the way that feels the most right for you what the reason we talked about it was because what we saw was the people in power pushing one narrative about this. And some of the results of the surgeries that we talk about in the book are really quite alarming to read about, that any child could actually consent to this. And then additionally, the medications that we're using, the history of those, where did they come from? So it's not a big piece of the book, but it was just an important part as we're going down the steps of labeling, because this was such a popular how do you identify story, as if to me, and I might be the weirdo on this one, as I'm identifying as the weirdo, that as if that means I really know you. I'd rather get to know you, who you are, how you, what makes you, who do you love, what do you love, what do you want to do, what do these words mean to you? Where I saw a very surface level discussion about this as well. So you're absolutely right. It's a contentious topic. There's research on both ways. There's advocates on both ways, and we tried our best to stay down the middle. But my concern was by medicalizing something that I was told is a normal part of everyday existence. It goes back to indigenous, times when pre-colonial times, we had this, but were we doing the surgical chemical intervention in those times, or were we accepting people the way they want to be accepted? It was the medicalization that was the worrying part to us.
Yeah, like what one of the things that you did write in the book was that many parents and youth actually do remain unaware to the known harms of using puberty blockers in particular. Are you suggesting that medical professionals aren't adequately informing parents and young people about the risks when discussing puberty blockers as a part of their gender-affirming care?
I don't know if I'm the equipped person to answer that, but can I answer it with a similar medicated with ADHD? Because I know much more about this. So I don't want to answer what doctor is equipped with what knowledge or not. What we saw was the spike, and then after the election, and this is troubling in both directions, we saw the drop after Trump came into power, and that could be people not feeling comfortable coming out and saying who they are. So both of these things are problems. So for instance, when we think of like ADHD, like we think of Ritalin, right? Like Ritalin was created by a European chemist for his wife to lose weight. He thought she was unfocused, she couldn't lose weight. It was only when we started testing this on kids, because we thought, well, she's focused, right? Her name was Marguerite, right? Rita. The Rita line. Adderall was a drug called Oblitarol that was for weight loss. And a company bought it and thought, this is a great idea for using on kids. And so they hired a marketing team and renamed it ADD for All Adderall. So this stuff, the idea that we all know the history of these medications, I mean, we used to use smoke enemas for people that drowned a few hundred years ago. That's why the saying is, what are you doing just blowing smoke up my ass? So this idea that there's this worldwide collusion of doctors trying to harm children, I don't fall for that trap. But I'm also weary of using a chemical intervention that did not come from a laboratory designed to treat what it was supposed to do. That's the part. So the chemical castration, people who have painful intercourse nowadays because of the medical intervention related to gender affirming care. That stuff worries me. When did the profession, did the people in power who are the professionals really know what they were, advocating for as a treatment? Let me say, and this is something going back to Nevin and I's work. If you feel compelled after this wonderful conversation, and I love the challenging questions, because it helps me wrap my head back around on all these things. If you pick up kids these days and you look at who's endorsed it, you will see Paris Hilton's name. Paris Hilton was sent to wilderness therapy programs and was harmed and abused on levels unbelievable. Nevin and I in the United States had relationships. I worked at similar programs. I didn't see what Paris talks about, but I saw harm. And I saw the harm more when I came to Australia, because I could look back and I went, if I did this here, I'd be in jail. Nevin was a researcher. He did his PhD about these programs. My PhD was about these programs. Now, what happened to Paris? This is the scariest part to me. It wasn't for a lack of experts and professionals. There was licensed social workers, psychologists, counselors. If you interview psychologists, it's something like there's a study out there. 50% of psychologists interviewed have said they've worked with a client who is, you know, sexually advanced on by another psychologist. Now, I'm not saying this is like, I'm not trying to poo-poo psychologists. What I'm trying to say is people in power do weird things in power that are really gross. Look at the headlines these days about the Epstein stuff. Everyone knew about this thing that nobody could solve. I know we're veering a little bit off track, but the reason Paris endorsed the book was because Nevin and I had a track record of calling this stuff out. Now, I would never tell someone don't receive the treatment that you think is the right treatment, because in the world of placebo, you have to go for the treatment you think is right. Don't do things you don't think are right. You're taking away a huge chunk of this. So with this important conversation, it's tricky, and we need to lift the veil on that we can talk about it openly, and that we can have a fair dialogue back and forth about this.
Yeah, you'd mentioned that your co-author, Nevin, while he was teaching in British Columbia, Canada, that he was instructed to not, I'm not sure if I'm getting you correct, but the teachers were instructed to not inform the parents of students that were identifying a particular way. Do you think that might be due to a lot of parental rejection and family violence that does come out of, you know, come from their children's, you know, revealing their gender identity to them? And, you know, that, which is also often cited as a major reason why trans youth are disproportionately represented among the homeless population. If parents were more accepting of their children's identities, would it follow that rates of homelessness among trans youth would also decrease?
That's another one I don't know the exact angle of. I think this is such a tricky conversation, because what it does to, I'm going to say this from the teacher's perspective, and I've never been a high school or elementary school teacher, so I have no idea what this is about. I did my entire life to get as far from those places as possible. But what it does is, we are all people that have values about things, and some values are not accepting of certain aspects of life. And I think that stinks. I think we should be welcoming for all people and treat all people with kindness. The issue was the top-down approach of telling all people, this is how you have to behave with your students now, even when it might not feel like the right thing at that time, even if you are an accepting person. And you know, we created the dichotomy of, are you an ally or a phobic? And so this is where I think what happened with this movement, and what Nevin was noticing as a professor who teaches, he was teaching in a school of education at the time this happened, was teachers were voicing, growing more concerned about, I have no idea how to talk with people, hear people, and I'm just told to affirm this and then do nothing about it. And I can't tell the parents, where we would tell, if your child did something naughty, we would say, oh, we got to talk to the parents. We got to make sure we're all on the same page on this. So it created this, parents are left in the dark, teachers are left with all this responsibility. And so I agree with you that, like, for instance, I mean, we wrote about this in the first chapter, that homosexuality was not removed from the DSM, the Book of Disorders, till 1987. Like, that's the year I was born. This is nuts. You know, same-sex marriage didn't come way later than that. So that was an othering of people and saying what they're doing is disordered. So what the issue I see with this one, this movement, is there, I'm going to be mindful of how I say this. Is there a, how does it increase inclusion by telling all the adults how to behave? Where what we need is a change of the environment that everybody feels welcome. And it's going to be very hard to advocate for this, for everyone to become welcome, when we're also calling everybody neurotypical who doesn't agree with me. So you see, we're doing the same thing both directions, where you're that, no way, you're that. And so instead, I think we need a giant community and social wake-up call that it's okay for people to be who they want to be, and we want to have a place for all of them that they can come. That's going to be really hard when we're telling people to keep secrets.
Mm.
So again, I'm not the guru on this, but it's just there was something we were witnessing where telling teachers they could not speak to the parents about a specific issue was quite alarming. And we also saw kids who, you know, young people who called things out and said, this doesn't make sense. We saw them being punished. So it was a lose-lose from the get-go. And we write about this story from Toronto, where a young boy from India moves to the school and they go to see a First Nations protest. Cool, awesome, about clean drinking water. And the school had a policy that everybody wears a shirt identifying as a colonizer. Now, this is a person from India. If you want to talk about the impacts of colonization on a country. And the kids, I think this was like sixth grade or something, year six. And the kids said, I don't want to wear this shirt. And the teacher said, you'll figure it out. You'll learn. Like, it's an egregious one-off story. But at the same time, this idea came from somewhere, and it came from you have to identify as something. That was really our fear of this, which is that's not how democracy works. Democracy works with everybody together. This is not going to work if everybody doesn't really have one vote. If you only can vote the way adults tell you to vote, or only vote the way that your club tells you to vote, you don't really have a vote anymore. So that was sort of the political undertone, was how do we get back to not necessarily just stark American individualism, but the notion that you have a safe place to participate. And if you can't speak up about something, you don't have the safe place to participate that you think you do. And that's both directions. That's for people advocating for better care, better affirming care. And how do you bring people that might not understand this, might have, you know, a more conservative lean, how do you bring them in? Well, you don't bring them in by saying you can't interfere with this. You bring them in with education and dialogue and being together and talking with each other.
Mm. So you feel that as an educator, withholding that information from parents might not have reduced the harm that, you know, making that action was intended, or?
Well, I think it does something to a family unit. And schools are this weird extension of family, right? Because that's where the kid goes all the time. So what I think happened is parents who wanted to raise their kid a certain way, the school now had more power, right? Now imagine, and this is an interesting thing that Nevin and I have been reading about after Kids These Days is done. Like, there's not really an institution with more power than the schooling system. So imagine if the church did this. It would really be like, wait, hold on a second. Every kid has to go to church, and every kid has to learn this certain way, and the school can withhold information about what the kids are doing from the parents. That would be really troubling to many of us. Substitute any religion into that, we'd all have an issue with this. But school is compulsory, set up by the government, and of course there's homeschooling and different things. So the issue that we had was it does undermine the family. Now that doesn't mean I moved halfway around the world from my family, right? Like, so I think that the issue, and I'd have to read up on the homelessness side, that what we're seeing is this notion that the school had ended up being able to take more power about something that was, and this is going to sound like I'm being nasty about it, a political and social movement, was able to hop on that. And that could be quite alarming because new things are scary. They're weird. They're different. And so that just like, I mean, the victory of same-sex marriage is one of the most amazing things. I flew home in 2012 with my kids to vote for it in my state of Maryland because I was like, this is amazing that we're getting here. That was not a big win for a lot of people. They were very upset about it. So the forcing of belief, that's the part that was a bit odd to me. And as someone who's as left and open and, you know, open as they come for democracy, that's the part that I found really troubling, was the silencing of dissenting voices, I don't think ever leads to anything good. So I'd have to read up on homeless, that area. And I think we've also, we can't have this conversation without saying the fact that we're having this conversation is a sign of how amazing the progress has been, that we can sit here and talk about it. That's incredible. That's amazing. The fact that kids feel comfortable saying this stuff is amazing. The fact that they feel comfortable saying this stuff in schools shows something about the quality of teachers that we have. So there's so many angles to look at this.
You're right. As social scientists, we understand the notion of gender roles as socially constructed. However, when social construction lead to medical interventions, we have a problem. Just to clarify what you mean by that, from your perspective as a social scientist, is this an area where intervention is nevertheless warranted?
Here's the tricky part about the gender side is, when we wrote this, I was reading a lot about a lot of feminist literature about these concepts, that there was a movement to decenter gender, to decenter that gender wasn't everything, so that we could get rid of the role of what it means to be this gender or that gender. Where the slippery slope lies is when that gets treated like natural law. So these are social constructions, which is fantastic, but we would never amputate a social construction. This is the part where it was really tricky to grapple with these ideas. My daughter went to a nice private school up the road, and she was told to wear a dress every day as part of her uniform. If she wore the wrong colored ribbon in her hair, she could get a detention. This stuff is laughable to me, right? I would think, I cannot wait for them to call me to tell me that you wore the wrong thing. I'm not interested in what people wear. It doesn't interest me. But that's about a gender construction of what it means to dress like a girl, right? So what we saw, this is what I kind of started observing, was it going the other direction. And again, we're speaking at big generalizations here, where the other direction was that gender, that construction of gender does not fit with me, and there's chemicals to sort this out. And so what sort of happened, and this is such great questions, like the difference of sex and gender, right? And so there's been debate about this back and forth, which one's more useful, which one's more scientific. I'm more interested in what's useful for the person. But so while this grew, what ended up happening was we started talking about these social constructions like they were natural law. And when we do this, sort of bad things can happen. And I'll say something from outside of medicine. In the U.S., they had broken window policy. This was a sociological idea from New York City where they said crime happens more often near broken windows. So we'll fix broken windows. It should reduce crime. But what it did is it told police officers people near broken windows are probably criminals. So they acted on it. And so this was an idea, and theories and science is just ideas, right? Like this was an idea that blew out of proportion. So one of the things is this what's happening with this discussion? Maybe, I don't know. But what I saw was from a philosophical point of view, we're kind of mixing ideas in different ways. And then I'm hearing recounts of people being harmed. And that's where we're like, we should actually have a little bit of caution around this. And I think in human society, we'll see the medicalization of this as a blip, and we'll all become much more accepting and welcoming of people. And then I think that can make a big difference. So that's a great question, but that's kind of old school. It's an old school philosophy way of thinking about something. Like for instance, if I go to, I don't want to use another religious example here, but if I climb a mountain and I go, oh my gosh, this is the best day of my life. Look at this amazing outdoor scenery. And this is stunning. And I feel rejuvenated. Like, it wasn't the mountain. That was my brain doing the work. And so socially, that came from somewhere. That doesn't mean we need to tell every single person to go climb mountains. Then we'll lose the magic of this thing. So it was the way that we wrote about it was, there's this social construction of gender. Everybody is on board with this. We should not tell people what job they can have because of their gender. We should not tell people how to identify, how to dress, which way to learn, going back to neurodiversity. We should not be telling anybody any of these things. At the same time, there is caution and a moral imperative of protecting children in particular from life-altering medications or surgeries. And so whatever an adult does, go for gold, you know, live your life, more power to you. That was the kind of worrying part. And we also heard stories that related to, let me go back to the Paris Hilton story. I've had a huge research database of outcomes. And I know we're rambling here a bit. And in that database of outcomes from these programs in America, there are stories in there of kids sent to residential treatment facilities based on the parents will write questions of their sexual orientation. And so we, Nevin and I both wrote, this: your sexual orientation or gender identity is no warrant to involuntary residential treatment. Like, that doesn't make any sense. So we see it used both ways, both directions, that you're harmed, you have to change this because it's not who you are. And then also the harm of an intervention that could hurt you as well. So we tried to grapple with something really difficult, and we didn't want it to be the noise of the whole book, because just like we're having, it's a conversation that's tricky, that there might not be a right answer. And so I'm just really grateful to have this conversation.
You mentioned that, if you're a consenting adult and you want to, go ahead with certain treatments, mm-hmm. then they should go for it. That's their prerogative. Am I getting that right?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. It's just that a part of the book, this is a pretty big package, passage. It was in response to the WPATH files, which were leaked. Do you want to talk a bit about what those are for our listeners who might not know about that leak?
So the WPATH files were the World Professional Association for Transgender Health, I believe, if I've got that right, the WPATH files. What happened is, this was the leading kind of authority on informing the medical profession on the gender-affirming care. And what happened is, I don't remember what the number is, but I'll make it up just like any researcher would. Like, thousands of documents got leaked that doctors were admitting that no child could actually actively consent to this because we didn't know what we were advocating for, and there's no way to consent to the harms that could come down the road later. Okay, so the issue with this story is also the issue of so many, I'll go back to the reason I'm one degree of separation from Paris Hilton. Everybody knew at these organizations that there were too many kids being harmed. Not enough people could stand up and say, hey, let's hit the stop button. We knew that the New South Wales government knew about poisoning Indigenous youth in New South Wales. Not enough people could stand up, and then it has to get leaked, and it has to be this dirty story instead of a story about everyone being involved in the well-being of youth. And I think that's the truth is, I think that's where most adults sit and where they stand is that I want to protect my youth. This is why you'd go, if we have to go down gender affirming care, let's do it. But there wasn't enough information to consent to what people were consenting to. Now, the damning part of that story and where it sits very polarizing is that it turned out that they were withholding information from families to make an informed decision. The same thing happened with a piece of research that came out that we wrote about in the book that some youth, one big piece of, I think this was National Institute of Health or National Institute of Mental Health in the U.S., a big piece of commissioned research said that they didn't want to publish their findings, that it didn't, that gender affirming care did not reduce feelings of depression or anxiety because it could be weaponized. So you see, this is the, I guess this is where Nevin and I sit in the really annoying middle of these discussions, is it's being weaponized both directions. And so what that means is we struggle to have a fair conversation about it, that both sides do the wrong thing all the time. And so that was the part where if you have a treatment that you have to protect or an idea you have to protect, you'll back yourself into a corner about this. We see this with the social media debate. Anytime there's a piece of research that comes out that says, actually, we can't find anything about social media, the loudest voices that are like, we have to ban social media, they're like, that research is flawed. You go, well, can we put our adults hat, or, you know, our adult hats on for a second and actually sit with something that's deeply complicated, controversial, and give our kids something to imitate, that life is really tricky and complicated? Like, this is complicated stuff.
Mm. Yeah, I guess the reason why that sort of popped into my head, the WPATH files that you do cite, there was one paragraph where you do mention that there were some side effects to puberty blockers that weren't made apparent to families. But in the same paragraph, you also mention a number of other procedures. You write, the files uncovered surgeons conducting procedures for some patients to live with both sets of genitals. In other words, phallus-preserving vaginoplasty, double mastectomies, removal of the nipples, and procedures called nullification, in which the genitals are removed and people are left with only smooth skin. So the second part of that paragraph, just to clarify, they're all procedures that were, that they weren't performed on anyone under 18. Those were procedures.
I wouldn't think so. I'm not sure. Yeah. I don't remember. I have to go back to the document.
Yeah, because just for the clarity of anyone that might read your book, that might be confusing. That might lead people to believe that these are actually procedures that were, conducted on, non-consenting children or adolescents. So, but that's not the case, is it?
I'm not sure. I don't think we would have written about things with adults, but we've written a little bit about young adults. But I'd have to go back and read that document again when that came out. My concern about talking about it was that the professionals were actively acknowledging that they also didn't know enough to provide the treatment that was given. We see this with, you know, this research is coming out about antidepressants today, and that as something that can really reduce your sexual drive. This was something we didn't know 30 years ago that now we do know. And so are we telling people that the longer you stay on this, your sexual drive could really decrease? So our view was that there was this covering up of something that we knew. And so I like to have trust in the experts around me, maybe not so much in the politicians, but in the experts around me. And so to see that covering up, that is also something that is nothing new to Nevin and I in the work we did in America, where we saw egregious cover up of young people dying from being outside. So that's the approach it took. So I'd have to go back and look at that. And I just don't want the listener to think like, those four pages or whatever they are were what we tossed over the most in the book, because it's such a hot topic and it's a contentious one where it's been very hard to have that conversation. And both of our partners, they both said, leave it in. And we went, okay. And so we left it in there. So, but yeah, it's one of the most difficult conversations, because also it's really hard to talk about the thing that everybody's talking about. And so that's where that was really tricky.
One of the things that you and Nevin argue is missing from young people's development today is the concept of risky play. For our listeners unfamiliar with the term, what does risky play mean to you? Or, you know, what do you mean by risky play in the context of the book that you've written?
Yeah, so one of the things that's happened is a lot of opportunities for play have been decreased. Structured stuff, school sport, things like this, that has increased. Risky play, however, is like sometimes unstructured. It can involve dangerous tools. It can involve height. And so what we've seen is a bit of a deterioration in that. This was interesting to talk to Dr. Sandseter from Norway, because her perspective was kids actually need this as a developmental thing. We see magazines and articles that rough and tumble play is really important. It helps you learn about your body. For young kids, it helps you learn about consent. When has this gone too far? Stop. I don't want to do this anymore. And we saw this rising rates of less and less play and more kind of control of the environment. So this was sort of one of the important topics was, and this is in the ideology section of the book, where risky play actually involves taking a risk. But, you know, Ellen calls it the R word. Like, the risk can have a benefit. Like, asking someone on a date is a risk. They might say no, they might say yes, it might change your life forever. And so children, when you observe them doing something risky, climbing a tree, maybe whittling something with a knife, chopping it, there's a risk they could get a cut for sure or fall out of a tree. But that child mentally is totally tuned into what they're doing. So even if they make a mistake, there's an opportunity to learn from what they're doing. So it's very mammalian. And so think about like rough and tumble play that fits in the category of risky play. Like if you buy a puppy, like you get a puppy, you take it to puppy school so it can learn how to fight with other dogs and not hurt them. So that's something dogs have to learn. And every now and then your dog will cross the line, and then that dog has to get, you know, told off by another dog. And we all go, this is the best way to have a safe enough dog. And so it's a very mammalian behavior. But what we've had happen is this overdoing of safetyism. You know, we talk about it as a safety trap, where we're seeing how far kids can go from home. This is sort of another one of the paradoxes of the phone. I threw my phone on the ground. But, you know, the paradox of the phone, you know, stranger danger. I don't want you outside. I don't want you walking to school. What if something bad happens? But here's a phone where 7 billion people can access you whenever they want. It's creepy, you know? So it's this backwards sort of view where we're protecting them from things that really are usually not that big of a deal.
Why do you think there are fewer opportunities for young people to engage in this type of play nowadays compared to previous generations?
I think one part of it is that no one wants to be the person that gets in trouble for hurting a child. Also, children, especially outside of school, don't spend time with other adults as often as they did. There's less sleepovers than before. There's less time where your kid gets to go with another adult. In the school system, and this started sort of in the 80s, there's this idea that Ulrich Beck, this German sociologist, talks about as the risk society, that what has happened is if you get in trouble, if a kid gets hurt in your school and you're the teacher on board, you've got to go talk to this person, that this news outlet, this thing. And there's too many people involved that we're scared of getting in trouble with. And what happens is it also turns out that no one's responsible for anything. So nobody actually wants to be responsible for the kid that gets hurt. You know, I'll have to get called to my boss. I'll have to deal with this. So we've outsourced risk everywhere. And so to the point, I mean, I'm not joking that in my state where I grew up in Maryland, they have banned physical touch on the playground. They have banned tag on the playground. No rough and tumble anything. There are schools in America that have banned imaginative play. So how do you control a child's imagination? This is, and again, I don't know who these people are that, you know, what educator is like, you know what I want to do every day? Police tag. Like, come on. So, but it is all about controlling risk. So that's been the biggest thing that I think we've seen that has changed, is that we're more conscious of risk, and maybe rightly so, but there's also a dignity of risk. You know, we've all seen One Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest, which is a whole movie about putting people into hospitals whose brains work differently and withholding all ability to do anything. And the most heart-lifting part of the story is breaking out of that place and taking a risk.
Yeah. By now, many listeners will be familiar with the debate around whether young people are being overly sheltered from discomfort or harm. In the book, you and Nevin point to examples such as reduced tolerance for dissenting views and increased requests for accommodations in classrooms to help students feel more comfortable. Do you feel this is unique to this particular generation that you're thinking about, or can we see evidence of things like this in previous generations as well?
Yeah, this is a great question. There's one part of this that adults for millennia have complained about kids being sheltered and overprotected. So that part hasn't changed. But then you can look at the things we can count, that the rates of accommodation have skyrocketed. And again, this is not something I lose sleep over in my classroom. I will do anything to help create a good learning environment for a student. What it also has, and this is the part that was sort of troubling, and Nevin working in a school of education might be a better person to talk about this, but there are some students who they come in and it's they cannot be called on in class, or they don't have to give a public presentation. What that means is we could have educators who have gone through the university system who have never given a presentation. So what I want, this goes back to what I said earlier about meet people where they're at and let's go somewhere, is you might sit down with a student, and this again goes back to like our relational view of this. Bring me your accommodation plan. Let's go through it. Some universities, this is more of a North America thing, they won't show you the accommodation plan. They'll just tell you this is how you have to behave as a teacher. And then you're in a lecture theater with 300 people going, how do I behave uniquely to one person in a room of 300? But what, and this is, we interviewed Michael Unger, Dr. Michael Unger, who is a resiliency expert, top-cited social work scholar in the world. And he said he sits with a student, goes through it, and goes, okay, in a few weeks, let's go back over this and see little things we can change. So he's not pushing someone like, let's rip up this piece of paper, screw it. It's, let's move on from here. And then maybe it might be going backwards. It might be, oh my gosh, you're too anxious. Let's move backwards. But it's about how do we increase participation and engagement in the material, not so there's no engagement in the material. So we have seen a rising rate of accommodations. And again, the word accommodation, again, this comes from disability literature. So like all of that is well and good and great. It's just about what's it doing for the experience of education. And again, I'm not super keen on the schooling system as a whole, but how can we make the experience of education more meaningful and engaging? So in some way, yes, this all makes sense. In another way, it might also withhold engagement in a non-meaningful way when it's not about specific things like here's a perfect example. We're banning the phones. Well, many people who might have an auditory processing concern might need the phone to record the lecture. Everybody's like, yeah, that's cool. Makes sense. That's fantastic. No problem. And then there's some that go to the, you can't be called on in class. That's like, what does this actually do? We should be nervous being around our educator because we're living up to their standards. So we just saw it was something that was growing and growing.
Are there ever any examples where a student is granted the types of accommodations that you're talking about, where it does increase their ability to learn better?
Yeah, I can think of plenty where they sit in a classroom. I can think of sometimes with extensions on assessments. Sometimes like our university will give someone a note taker so they can sit and focus on the lecture. Someone else could take the notes. Fantastic. I think one of the greatest gifts of online learning is that every Zoom thing can be recorded. You can come back and watch it. Additionally, I think of things that the way I'm a learner of is I love writing, but I love apps like Speechify. I love putting what I wrote and making it into a podcast and walking around with it and going, how would this come across to somebody else? How does this actually sound to another person? So I think there's tons of ways accommodations can help. Similar to labeling, I think there's a ton of ways that people get a diagnosis. They go, finally, I understand who I am. Then I want to make sure it helps you in the environment that you're in. It helps you to thrive in that environment. So that is sort of the angle that we took on this.
You group many of these trends under, correct me if I'm wrong, but you group many of these kinds of trends as what you call safetyism. Could you define what you mean by safetyism for our listeners?
Sure. So there are things that were happening on college campuses and especially in the US where campuses were given safe spaces. And again, feels right, great idea. And then what that turned into was safety from ideas. I have to be in a safe place. I can't hear that lecture talk. I can't hear this lecturer say these things. We can't have the conversation that you and I just had about different issues. What that turned into was everyone was scared to talk about anything. And so what that meant is only the loudest voices got the most power. Like I said, when Trump got his second term and we see this plummet of those of young people identifying as a gender other than the binary ones, what happened there was it was no longer a safe place for this idea. So what ends up happening, and this is what is fascinating about this to us, is it actually limits really good conversation and really good learning. And I'm learning from this conversation with you. So safetyism, it's not only on the playground, it's not only those things. It was happening in the classroom where we were told what to talk about, how to talk about it, these things. And it was mostly dressed up in a political view. You have to align with this political view, of which most people in my profession align to a certain political view, right? But so this idea of safetyism, what it meant was that dissenting voices were off limits. Now, let me say where this gets really weird and creepy. I've written a paper that said the legalized kidnapping of youth to programs in America is wrong. And then it gets a request for retraction because that's dissenting to my professional community about something that everybody agrees with, just not the researchers funded to deliver this research. When Tyrone Hayes researches atrazine and he says, I don't think this is good. It's an endocrine disruptor. It's going to lead to increased cancer rates. The company that paid Tyrone Hayes to do it says, actually, research it again. So safetyism goes both ways. It really should be called more protectionism, that it's protecting us from things that might challenge us and might actually push us forward.
If safetyism is part of the problem, what do you see as a healthy antidote to safetyism being imposed on children and adolescents?
I think this is such a wonderful topic because as I finish the book and where my head's at now thinking about what the heck am I going to do next, our world right now is in this place where everything is a threat to democracy. We see this with how our political leaders are acting, what is talked about, what's not talked about, the way we treat people, the way we treat each other, the way we treat complicated discussions. How dare they say that? These sort of things. What I see about safetyism and the antidote is actually more democracy, more being together, more talking with each other, more the ability to read what someone who I disagree with thinks, the ability to come together as communities and be together, because other people will view safety and protection differently than you will. And if you find middle ground, it's fantastic. So I come from Washington, D.C. Like, I come from this political epicenter where nobody talks to each other. You only talk to people you agree with. But I've also worked in West Virginia. I've worked in Alaska. I've worked in Australia. I've been to Norway. I've been to Greenland, which is a very hot topic at the moment. Like, going and being with other people is the best thing you can do to get out of your own echo chamber. And it's the best way to give kids something to imitate. We write about this in that identity chapter we've spent a lot of time talking about, that one of my dearest friends growing up, we have a picture of us in diapers together. His view of gun ownership in America is totally different. We flew him out to Australia when he left the U.S. Army. He came and worked with me in the bush with young people. It was fantastic. Our kids still remember the debate we had about gun ownership and how three people, my partner Renee and I and our friend, could argue, get heated, listen, and then go watch a movie on the couch. That we need to come together and talk about these things. And that will mean if we start there, we'll start being able to listen, and then we can take risks. And then the truth is, it's a safer place for everybody and a braver place for everybody. That's sort of the ethos of the book, is let's talk about these things so you can make a decision for you and I can make a decision for me. And then we can all be one world, one people, be together.
I guess to finish up, in the book you describe the Norwegian concept of, and I'm really glad that you wrote this out phonetically, of friluftsliv.
Yeah, that's good enough for me. Yeah. Friluftsliv. Yeah.
Friluftsliv. What is friluftsliv? And do you feel it could potentially be an antidote to the safetyism that you mentioned?
Sure. And I know you want to ask if this is possible in Australia as well. So, yeah. So Friluftsliv is this idea. It's kind of a Norwegian philosophy of an open air lifestyle. So if any one of the listeners have traveled to Scandinavia, they have freedom to roam laws. What that means is that you can camp wherever you want as long as you are far away enough from someone's house. So there are not fences at farms. People will take their sheep and put them out there. If you go out into the wilderness, into the woods, and you go camping and you get stuck and caught out in a snow blizzard, let's say, and you call whatever their version of 000 is, they will come get you for free, because they don't want you to be scared of going out and enjoying the beautiful areas of this place. So friluftsliv is an idea, and here are some interesting concepts. I know fire is different in Australia, and especially, you know, this week when we're recording this interview. One thing is, in Australia, we often say, use contained fireplaces, use this. And then after people have used it, we see it full of broken bottles, full of cigarette butts, full of trash. And then you go out into nature, you go to this campsite, you go, this place is a dump. That, I think, to me, comes from this is the same thing in America, by the way. Many people growing up in a place where we don't have that connection to the country of where we're coming from. So people might say in Norway, I had this experience when we were on expedition. We made a fire pit, cooked dinner, slept the night, camped. And I got up and I started taking apart the fire pit. And I was like, we don't want this trash. There's no trash in the fire pit. We just don't want to leave it. We want it to feel natural. And they're like, nah, someone will come use this. It's great. Leave it like that. So there's this idea of, if we're in the outdoors, it's healthier. So there's a better connection to the outdoors. Where, here's another wild one. If, let's say, you and I found a group of 10 Australian kids and I said, come watch my work, Mark. Let's go to Norway and we're going to run this expedition. You would say to me, okay, we need public liability insurance. Nah. Like we would in Australia, but there, Norwegian kids would just be taken outside, right? Again, another one would be, what land are we going to use? Think of this kind of colonizing language. What land are we going to use? Now we can just go use it. Well, what about the risk? Who's going to get us out? the government if something goes bad. In Australia, we need a commercial tourism license. We need to know all the rules of whatever national park we're using. And so there is this, in Australia and in the US, many countries around the world, there is this fenced-in notion of the outdoors, right? Which is a really bizarre thing when we're all in a decolonizing. And I know we have to protect the land. We have to protect all of us from bushfires. We have to protect the native species. I get that part of it. But there's also a much larger disconnect from the indoors and the outdoors from a place like Norway, Sweden, Finland, Latvia, all these places. I'm standing here. I'll show this, even though this isn't a video record. I've got a dear friend from Latvia. She just visited Norway. She brought me canned moose and canned elk, and I'm too scared to open it. So it's still sitting on my desk. But no, the difference of the cultural view to the outdoors. Now, it's not just Norway. You go to Japan and Korea. This is the rise of forest therapy, forest bathing. Well, think of Japanese culture. Everything has meaning. So, of course, the forest has meaning. So their connection is different to Norway, but it's not as capitalistic as it is in many other Western places. So it's fascinating.
Thank you, Will, for talking about your book with us on Brainwaves this evening. If our listeners would like to discover more about your work, where can they find that?
Sure. So my name is quite unique, Will Dobud. So if you Google that, any social media will pop up. You can find me wherever. We have a website for the book called kidsthesedaysbook.com. And so I think anywhere you want to reach out, I'm a pretty open book as well, as I hope people could see from this talk, that I'm always keen to talk to new people and be challenged and pushed. And that's one of the best parts of my job, not only as an academic, but as a practitioner and someone who gets to talk about this stuff. So feel free to reach out, a follow on all the social medias, Substack, I'm up there too. Doing interviews with other wild people as well. So, yeah, no, thank you so much, Mark, for having me. It's been a real treat.
You've been listening to a 3CR podcast produced in the studios of independent community radio station 3CR in Melbourne, Australia. For more information, go to allthews.3cr.org.au.